Iran's delegation to the talks between the signatories to the nuclear deal says Washington must remove sanctions before Tehran resumes compliance with the deal. Russian President Vladimir Putin accuses Ukraine of provocative actions in East Ukraine that's inflaming the situation there. Poland reports 28,000 new COVID-19 infections and 954 new deaths, bringing the death toll to well over 56,000. Hi, everybody. Omar, Tehran headquarters with me, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. We conducted an interview with Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. He told us about his meeting with the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi. Let's take a listen.
Mr. Araghchi, thank you again for your time. You just came out of your meeting with Mr. Grossi. Can you tell us about the purpose of this meeting and the outcome?
Well, I had a very useful and constructive meeting with the Director General, Rafael Grossi. I briefed him on the latest situation in the current negotiations with JCPOA participants. Obviously, the agency is going to have a very important role in the verification of activities by Iran. If we come to an agreement, if we come to a conclusion in our current negotiations, then the agency should play its role. And because of that, it was needed that we discuss with the Director General how to continue our cooperation in this field. We have also some outstanding questions which we had to, coordinate. We continue to engage with the agency on those outstanding questions, and I am confident that we are able to resolve those questions as soon as possible. I expressed Iran's good faith and Iran's readiness to get engaged with the agency in this regard, and I think Iran and the agency are in a good track.
And concerning the working groups that are currently discussing those two different aspects that we mentioned earlier, can you tell us if they've reached any particular conclusion up until this stage?
Well, we are still far from getting to a concrete conclusion, but I can say that we are progressing well. And our experts have had intensive discussions in the past 2 days. Today they continued, and I think tomorrow morning we would be in a position to evaluate what they have done so far and to see how we should continue. Tomorrow we would have another Joint Commission meeting in order to see, to hear the reports of the two working groups and decide how we should continue this job. We would go for a 2-3 days break and then come back next week to continue negotiations.
Can I just ask a final question? Iran's Atomic Energy Organization has said that the reversal of some measures is going to be time-consuming. Is there a plan for Iran to reverse its measures on a gradual basis before the verified removal of U.S. sanctions?
Well, these are subjects to detailed negotiations. As far as we are concerned, the U.S. should lift its sanctions first, and that should be done in one step, and then we verify, and after verification, we do our part of the job. We go back to full compliance. How to do that? How to verify the U.S. Measures, how to verify Iran's measures, how long does it take, and how long does it take for Iran to come back to full compliance? These are details that we are going to negotiate in the coming days.
Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll be waiting to see what comes out of the tomorrow meeting. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says that Muslim nations have been the victim of organized Islamophobia.
The world of Islam has been targeted by Islamophobic measures that have been occurring in an organized manner. In other words, the values and the lofty goals of Islam have been targeted, and that brings about major economic and developmental consequences for Muslim nations.
Rouhani made those comments addressing the 10th summit of the Organization of Developed Countries, or the D8, that was hosted by Bangladesh. He said independent states have long been hit by unilateralism and economic terrorism, which pose a serious threat to the international community. Rouhani stressed that the D8 nations and other Muslim states have large markets for investment. The president also slammed U.S. unilateralism and said Washington has failed in its attempts to bring the Iranian nation to its knees. Well, speaking of U.S. lifting of sanctions and Iran verifying it, we have leaders' Instagram page. We have reaction there that verification sanctions should mean that Iran will be able to receive the revenues from the oil sale, naturally. Now, political commentator Yvonne Ridley says that anti-Muslim policies are becoming part of the French political landscape, creating a frightening outlook for the future of Muslims in France.
But what is frightening is the array of anti-Muslim policies that are now becoming part and parcel of the French political landscape. And so Iran's President Hassan Rouhani, his speech is most welcome, I would imagine, for most Muslim women, because Muslim nations are being targeted for organized Islamophobia. There's no other way to describe what is unfolding in France and elsewhere in the world today. So his intervention is certainly most welcome. And thank goodness there's a Muslim leader who's prepared to stand up and speak out against this oppression of these women.
Not one Yemeni child has been killed in the Saudi-led forces artillery shelling on the southwestern Idlib, that's Dali province. According to Yemeni media, the victim and his father were targeted near their house in the Hasha district. The father sustained injuries. Reports also indicating that Saudi missile strikes hit a residential area in Yemen's northwestern Sada province. No report on the possible casualties. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. It imposed a crippling blockade on the impoverished nation, and as a result, tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives. Damascus has called on the United Nations Security Council to take decisive and immediate measures to end Israeli strikes on Syrian territory. The Syrian foreign minister asked the UN body to hold Israel accountable for what it calls the regime's terrorism and crimes against Syrian people. This after Syria's air defenses intercepted a number of Israeli rockets over the southern parts of the capital, Damascus. The attack left four Syrian soldiers wounded, causing some material damage. Israel has repeatedly performed strikes against Syria over the past years. Russian President Vladimir Putin is accusing Ukraine of provocative actions near its eastern borders and purposefully exacerbating the situation on the front line. Now, those comments came in a phone call with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. In a readout of a conversation, the Kremlin said that both sides voiced concerns over a spike in tensions in East Ukraine. Meantime, a senior Kremlin official says that Russia will defend its citizens in the Flashpoint region depending on the scale of the military confrontation. The Ukrainian president has urged NATO to speed up his country's membership plan, heating up tensions with Moscow. Russia and Ukraine have had a long-standing conflict focused on Crimea and Donbass regions. Moscow is also at odds with NATO over the eastward expansion of the military alliance. It's now time for the news review section. China has lashed out at the UK for granting asylum to a Hong Kong protest leader, calling it a gross interference in the city's judicial system.
The UK side provides public platform for Hong Kong separatists and so-called refuge for wanted criminals. This is a gross interference in Hong Kong's judicial system and runs contrary to the basic principles of international law and international relations, as well as the principles of the rule of law, which the UK so proudly boasts.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry also urged Britain to immediately, quote, correct its mistakes and stop interfering in Hong Kong's matters and Chinese domestic issues. On Wednesday, Hong Kong protest leader Nathan Law said that he has been granted asylum by the UK government. He has lived in London since last July. Last year, Beijing approved a national security law for Hong Kong following months of protests there. Britain says that the law breaches freedoms in the city, but China says it helps improve security there. London has recently unveiled a new immigration scheme that facilitates the immigration of Hong Kong citizens to Britain. Now, let me invite a couple of guests to our news review show. We'll have Bijan Tavassoli, who's a political commentator in Hamburg. Also joining us is Walter Smolarek, editor of the Liberation News out of Philadelphia. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Now, Bijan, China is calling this gross interference in its domestic affairs and also Hong Kong's affairs. What's your assessment of this? What do you call that?
I can only agree with that assessment. Because don't let yourself be deceived by his name. Mr. Law is in fact a dangerous criminal, and his unlawful activity has included collaborating with US and UK intelligence agencies, openly collaborating against his own people, and he should be put before a judge in China and not seek asylum in the UK.
Mm-hmm. And Walter, we have we hear Beijing usually blame external powers like the U.S. especially, and also the U.K. here, as we are hearing about it, the interference in Hong Kong's affair. What's in it for the U.S. And later on also for the U.K., I'll ask you about it, in actually certain the situation as Chinese are claiming in Hong Kong?
Certainly. Well, the United States wants to take advantage of every division, every fault line within Chinese politics and society. And so the division between the mainland and Hong Kong, which is a legacy of British colonialism, and in fact one of the most infamous crimes of European colonialism, I mean the Opium Wars, is definitely one of these fault lines that the United States has long identified as a potential pressure point. It's similar to their logic about pushing the issue of Xinjiang. It's similar to the logic of pushing the issue of Taiwan. Any piece of China that they can try to carve off, Tibet is another example of this, any piece of China that they can carve off or inflame tensions between that particular region and the central government, they want to do that. So supporting forces like those around Nathan Law or just the Hong Kong protesting movement more generally is something that threatens the territorial integrity of China, which again, going back centuries, has been a key strategy by Western powers, including the United States, to dismember, dominate, and control China.
Mm-hmm. And Bijan, what would have happened if China had done the same thing? I mean, the same thing that the other countries do and the UK is doing? I mean, giving asylum to a protest leader.
Yeah, so China has never engaged in interference in other nations, other sovereign nations' affairs. But of course, you can see that there's many fault lines within British politics, just to mention the issue of Scotland. Or when we are on the issue of British colonialism, then the Irish question is still not resolved. And Sinn Féin leaders could ask for help from other nations to finally resolve the question of Irish independence after centuries of British colonialism. So the British colonialists are really in a position where they should atone for their sins that they have committed, the crimes they have committed on peoples all over the world, and not seek to interfere in other sovereign nations' affairs.
Okay. And Walter, what kind of a prospect do you depict for this thing going on between China, the U.S., and the U.K., and the Western world regarding what is China is calling its own internal issues?
I think we have to anticipate the tensions becoming substantially worse. The dominant foreign policy and military circles, certainly in the United States, and I think this is true in the UK as well, view great power competition as their framework, and that means that the West versus China, a locked-in conflict over who will become the dominant world power, the United States and the UK, the traditional powers trying to hang on to their dominance. I mean, that's the framework through which all of the most important political leaders in both the United States and the UK view this conflict. And so I think that the support for separatists in Hong Kong and in other parts of China will increase. We've also seen, for instance, sanctions being used, as part of that too, right, to support Xinjiang separatist organizations. But, the economic war that was initiated by Trump, those tariffs are still in place. Mm-hmm. And the massive military buildup, I mean, this is the most troubling, the massive military buildup led by the United States, but joined in by the UK, around China's borders, especially their maritime borders, is something that also shows no signs of letting up. So I think this is one step, you know, the asylum to Nathan Law is one step down a road that we've already traveled quite a ways. China's position has always been that they want, that they desire win-win cooperation with all other world powers, that they want a new model of relations where sovereignty and independence is respected. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly not the vision of world affairs that the Pentagon or State Department planners have in mind.
Looking pretty grim picture, then. Okay, for your comments, we had Bijan Tavassoli, political commentator who joined us from Hamburg, and Walter Smolarek, editor of the Liberation News out of Philadelphia, with their comments. And that's it for this news review. Welcome back. Northern Ireland leaders have united in condemnation of the violent unrest between police and pro-British unionist protesters in the capital, Belfast. In an emergency meeting, the all-party executive came together and delivered a statement calling for an end to the destruction and violence. The executive said that no matter what concerns exist in communities, violence is completely unjustifiable. Dozens of people, mostly police officers, have been injured in nightly protests that started on Sunday. Demonstrators are opposed to post-Brexit trade barriers between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. Restrictions are to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Ireland. Critics say that the barriers will strain the region's ties with the remaining part of the UK. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on European countries. Poland reported 954 new deaths, bringing the fatalities from COVID-19 to well over 56,000. It registered around 28,000 new infections, pushing the caseload to 2.5 million. In Russia, 365 new daily deaths were officially reported. It takes the fatalities to nearly 102,000. New cases also rose. They actually surpassed 4.6 million. In Germany, the number of confirmed cases rose by more than 20,000 to nearly 3 million. There were also 306 new fatalities, pushing the death tally to above 77,000. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
welcome to the lighter side of the news. It's great to have you with us. Now, cheese goes well with food items indeed, especially on the breakfast table in almost every home. But have you ever tested halloumi? The rubbery cheese I'm talking about from Cyprus, which now gets EU-protected status. Halloumi is a traditional homemade item in Cyprus, with historical accounts suggesting its production as early as the 16th century, believe it or not. Now, the salty cheese is the country's second most valuable export. In Turkish, it is known as helim. Europe has now decided to recognize halloumi, called white gold by dairy farmers, as a unique thing to be divided in the eastern Mediterranean island there. Locals usually enjoy it tossed in the frying pan or barbecued, eaten raw with melon in the summer, or cubed and thrown into the boiled with soup.
A baby capybara has found a new family at a zoo in the Colombian city of Cali after she was abandoned by her mother soon after birth last December. The little capybara is 3 months old and is under the care of a surrogate mother who is in charge of providing her with the skills she needs for optimal development. The baby capybara was rejected shortly after birth by her first-time parents. But the zoo hopes that in a couple of months, she will be able to unite with another female of the same species.
As the COVID-19 pandemic has affected most sectors in one way or another, the Swiss tech firm has created a robot that can disinfect airplanes in a few minutes. The startup, called Uvea, says the robot emits powerful ultraviolet lights as it slowly moves down the aisle, killing 99% of bacteria and pathogens, including the coronavirus. The company says a robot can disinfect a single aisle in 13 minutes. The startup co-founder says the UVC technology has been used for decades in hospitals and labs. He says the fact that the rays could be harmful to humans prompted them to seek an autonomous robot that can carry out the task.
It's quite an old technology, but it's quite dangerous. That's why we want to take the worker out of the range of the light. So that's why we made a robot, because there is some solution when you are near the light, and that's dangerous. So we really had to make this system autonomous. So we switch it on, we leave, the machine makes the disinfection, all the plane, all around, and then it stops automatically. So the worker are not in contact with the machine.
The company is hopeful that technology could help restore travelers' confidence in safe air travel and help bring the worst-hit aviation sector back to its feet.
Now, in Egypt, more than 20 ancient royal mummies have been paraded to a new museum to be displayed in greater splendor. The mummies include 18 kings and 4 queens who were taken from the Egyptian Museum in central Cairo's Tahrir Square. They were transferred to the National Museum of Egyptian Civilization in Fustat, which lies some 5 kilometers to the southeast of the capital. The ceremony aimed to drum up interest in Egypt's rich collections of antiquities at a time when tourism has entirely stalled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Archaeologists discovered the mummies in 2 batches at the complex of mortuary temples of Deir al-Bahari, located on the west bank of Nile. High-tech light displays at the Beijing International Light Festival provide an immersive experience to visitors and create a miraculous night scene by illuminating the sky. The festival is held in a major urban park in the Chinese capital, Beijing, also a popular site for enjoying cherry blossoms in the spring. As the sun goes down, the park is illuminated with a high-tech light show every evening, and nature's beauty is highlighted with a little help from technology.
The theme of our show this year is Blue Space. We've created a universe in which there's the blue planet. The visitors come in as explorers from Earth, they board the spacecraft, and it takes them to the blue planet. And the installations they see in the park are different biolandscapes on planet Blue. There, they need to complete several tasks, which are the interactive installations we've set up. So the exhibition is immersive and interactive.
The exhibition uses 19 different types of lighting equipment to give visitors an unforgettable experience. This is the second year for the Beijing International Light Festival and will last until October 2021.
Painting eggs is a beloved tradition amongst Christians, especially Orthodox, on the occasion of Easter, symbolizing the resurrection of Jesus Christ. A veteran Hungarian artist has taken that craft to a whole new level. 67-year-old Tunde Chuhai has been designing eggs for decades. Each of her delicate creations takes days to make. Chuhai uses various kinds of eggs and says the best one comes from geese. She starts her craft by emptying the eggs through tiny pinholes before washing and then drawing patterns on them. The veteran egg designer says her style is so unique that she doesn't have to sign her eggs.
I never sign my eggs, as everyone knows they were done by me. I don't have to particularly prove that I did it because my style is so distinctive, even though others may use similar techniques.
Chuhai's decorative Easter eggs are very popular, so she has to work all year round to meet the demands. Her work is internationally recognized and has featured in galleries both at home and abroad. This year, however, her miniature creations have to stay at home with her due to the coronavirus pandemic. The young British man who is no stranger to danger takes his life in his hands, free climbing one of the highest skyscrapers in Europe. George King made his way to the top of a 116-meter hotel in the Spanish city of Barcelona without any ropes or safety measures. The 21-year-old scaled the building in only about 20 minutes. However, as he was climbing down the building, he was arrested by police. This is not the first time the British daredevil has risked his life with such a nail-biting climb. Last December, he scaled Barcelona's iconic Agbar Tower with a height of 144 meters. In 2019, he also free-climbed the 310-meter Shard building in London. The feat, however, earned him 6 months in a young offenders center.
A chocolate maker in the Belgian city of Bruges has come up with a novel recipe to boost business in the run-up to Easter.
When you're a classic chocolate maker, make very classic recipes. Caramels, praliné, marzipan, and it's okay. We have classic bonbons too. But I think today, the customer wants to go on adventure, also when they are eating something.
The chocolatier's special concoction is a praline made of grass juice, Granny Smith apples, and an East Asian type of lemon. He believes chocolate contains a secret ingredient that can counter the lockdown gloom. Belgium is known as the chocolate capital of the world. The northern city of Bruges is in particular renowned for treating your taste buds to quality cocoa. However, the coronavirus pandemic has diminished foreign tourist numbers, with businesses now relying on local customers. This is heart-melting. A video of a stray cat carrying her sick newborn kitten to a veterinary clinic in Turkey is melting hearts online. Veterinarians were confused as a cat walked into their clinic clutching one of her kittens in her mouth. The cat then meowed for a long time and brought in a second kitten of hers. After a quick examination, the vets noticed that the kittens couldn't open their eyes due to an eye infection. The clinic staff immediately treated the animals, helping them open their eyes after a while. The stray feline and her kittens were placed in adoption after the completion of their treatment. nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Magura River to see stunning cherry trees in full bloom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the coronavirus pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital were also canceled.
In the heart of one of the oldest districts in the U.S. state of California, there is a historical little printing house that is receiving a new lease on life. The building and its equipment were slowly dying out, and its machines were good for scrap. The iconic printing house was on the verge of bankruptcy until a group of artists revived this beacon of traditional typography. They used what was already present in the building, including the tools and hand printing knowledge. Artists are able to print their new age designs using these old printing methods. Some of the machines date back to the late 1800s. La Linterna was first founded to print newspapers. Later on, it began printing cinema and concert posters for famous artists.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Who Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Who Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, right here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This is chemical warfare that you're not supposed to be able to use on U.S. soil.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Street?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras, right on the streets, in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Richard was saying, it is an incredibly big topic, lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Luke, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm-hmm. But as we know, the African-American community have been plagued by police brutality mm-hmm. for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seeing very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and color pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, it on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the street with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying, the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a in a liberal democracy in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak, but then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comment that they make to the cameras,
but they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale, of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial
did see
inequality.
A lot of white people in the crowds in support of the black.
Yeah.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies, this is two of them for me, so when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff, and that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
An endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I liked the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in you know, making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks, and they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that monitorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long
a brief break now from a discussion. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017 and is on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of U.S. Justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017. Those are the numbers you expect in a small war somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is. It's a Jim Crow style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean everywhere. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, It's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of oppressive policing and marginalization and it's that system that's carried on
and people are
just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world. And it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.